Our next speaker is Edwin Graham, who is a principal actuarial data scientist based in the UK. He joined Accurate in 2021 with a decade of experience in insurance pricing. He holds a master's degree in mathematics from Lancaster University and is a keen cyclist and field hockey player in his spare time. Thanks, Edwin. We're looking forward to your insights.
Hi, everybody. Thanks to Asa for inviting me to speak. I'm by no means as polished as Bruce, the previous speaker, but I'm going to do my best. I'm going to be talking to you on automated approaches for insurance pricing. I'm going to really talk about two approaches that are automated, one called Derivative Lasso, and this is a GLM-based, table-based way of automating your pricing models, and maybe better known, GBMs. But I'm going to start off talking about traditional insurance pricing models, GLMs. They've been around for probably 20, 30 years now, particularly in short-term insurance. Why? Because they're very predictive, they're very flexible, they're transparent, understandable, easy to build and put into production, and I don't think they're going anywhere anytime soon. So how do you go about building a GLM? It's a manual approach. You're going through variable by variable, manually transforming those variables into something that has a linear relationship with the target that you're modeling. And the fact that they're manual has its pros and cons. So, of course, it's really useful because it means that as we're... Yep. Thank you very much. That's why it's going the opposite way. The fact that it's manual is really, really useful in some respects, because it means that at each iteration when we're building our models, we can add our domain knowledge, our expertise, inject that into the modeling process. But it also has its downsides, which is they take a long time to build, and they take time to maintain, and they could be many, many models, frequency, severity models across many perils. And the people typically building these models are actuaries who... they're some of the most valuable resources that an insurance company has. And it's not always necessarily the best use of their time if this can be done in a more automated way. So one downside is that the transformations that we make when we're building a GLM can be or seem quite arbitrary. So, for example, we will typically model data sets where there are many nonlinear relationships between the input variables and the target we're trying to model. So an example would be in motor pricing, the age of the main driver, typically the risk drops very quickly as the driver becomes more experienced, then kind of flattens out and then maybe ticks up again. As they get older. So it's not a linear relationship. And oftentimes we model these nonlinear relationships using quite arbitrary transformations. So probably a polynomial transformation is quite common. And there's no real real life reason to believe that the relationship is follow some cubic or quadratic curve. It seems quite arbitrary, and that could be a weakness of the model. Let me move on. So how can we move past manual GLM techniques and do something that is a bit more standardized, a bit more automated, but where we still are able to inject our expertise and domain knowledge into the process? Here we have a mind map of table-based, GLM-based models. GLM itself is a generalization of linear models, but we can further sort of generalize the idea of GLMs. So the ones I want to focus on are the ones highlighted in red. So one idea to generalize is to introduce penalization. So penalization, maybe lasso penalization or ridge regression, you may have heard of. These are ways to get a better trade-off between the complexity of your model, a better trade-off between the robustness and, of your model, the sensitivity to data, and the complexity of the model, how well it can find signal in your data. And it does this by putting a constraint on the size of the coefficients that a GLM can fit. So lasso regression, which is what we're going to focus on later, does this by putting a constraint on the sum of the absolute values of the coefficients, whereas ridge regression is a constraint on the sum of the square of the coefficients. The other thing I want to focus on is GAMs, G-A-Ms. These are ways, there's a family of possible GAMs. You might have used cubic splines or something like that in the past. And these are where we're fitting a function rather than a linear relationship within the GLM framework. So here is how GAM models generalize that idea of GLM. So at the top, you can see what a linear model is. We just have a linear relationship between the predictors and the output. GLM generalizes this by adding a link function and having different assumptions about the distribution of the errors. GAM can generalize this further by, instead of having this linear relationship, having some parameterized function instead that we can fit, at fitting time, the parameters will be fit, and some function that's nonlinear will be fit. So that could be cubic splines, or in the derivative lasso example I'm going to give in a moment, it will be a step function. So derivative lasso has these features. It has penalization, essentially you can think of it as a GAM where we're fitting a step function through the variables we're fitting into our model. Here is the outline of how derivative lasso works. So first of all, any continuous variable in your model, in your set of candidate variables, we want to bin. So for example, driver age could be quite naturally binned into integer ages, but something a bit more continuous, you might have to think a bit more carefully about what a natural binning might look like. Typically, we don't want thousands and thousands of bins, but 20, 50 would work quite well. We're going to, for each bin, assign one coefficient in the GLM model. But when we come to the fitting time, we're going to apply a penalty on the size of this coefficient. We're going to use penalized regression. And in derivative lasso, we're going to apply that penalty for the ordinal variables, actually not to the coefficient itself, but to the absolute value of the difference between neighboring coefficients and the sum of this absolute value, with some weighting involved. And why do we do this? Because, by having many, many, many bins, and many, many, many coefficients, if we fit without any regularization, we're going to massively overfit. We're going to have a model that's very, very sensitive to the data. It's going to fit very, very well to the training data, but it's going to generalize really badly. It's going to have a variance problem. Applying regularization allows us to reduce that model complexity. So essentially, the model complexity is being reduced in the lasso framework. Coefficients can be reduced entirely to zero and drop out of the model entirely. And with the derivative lasso framework, that means that we are fitting a step function where we're grouping the nearby, the, you know, the neighboring terms within your bins. So this is going to move us from a model that has very high bias left towards a simpler model. Has very high variance left towards a simpler model where you might have more bias, but ultimately there's going to be some sweet spot where the level of penalization gives us a model that is neither oversensitive to the data and overfitting, nor is it so robust that it's not soaking up signal. And that's what we want. So, of course, on the training data, we can't really measure the impact of the variance. Everything looks like an improvement. What we really care about when we're building our models is how well a model's generalize on data it hasn't seen. So for that reason, we hold out some data, and you know, when we're fitting, we can judge the strength of the regularization penalty using the goodness of fit on the holdout data. So this is what it looks like in practice. So this is a single variable being fit with lasso regression. We have a number of bins, I think 16 or 17 bins, for the variable vehicle age. What we're seeing is the observed, in this case, it could be claims frequency. Oh, no, it's not. It's average loss cost. And we're fitting a model to this. Here we have an example where we have very high smoothness, meaning a high penalization, a high lasso penalty. And you can see the effect of this is that many of the levels are grouped together. So I think level 0 to 9 is grouped together and 10 to 16. And you can see in this case we are basically underfitting. So this is one where the penalization would be too high. But you can see the effect as we reduce that penalization, we fit closer and closer to the data. In this case, maybe this model looks the best, but that's not necessarily the true because it's fitting very, very closely to the data. We'd have to look at the goodness of fit statistics, but let's just run that again because it looks quite nice to animate. You can see the effect of the penalization and how, you know, the more we reduce it, the more we fit to the data, we risk overfitting, but in this case it looks quite a nice fit. So in a derivative lasso framework, that's what we do with the ordinal data. For the categorical data, where we don't have any idea of an order, we can simply apply a lasso penalty directly to the coefficient. And this has an effect of pulling the coefficient down to zero, which in a log link model, which is very common for frequency, severity, pure premium models, that would be a 1.0 multiplicative factor. So if there's lasso has the effect that it can pull coefficients all the way to zero, and that means that, you know, when there's not enough signal for whatever level of penalization you're applying, the coefficient will go exactly to 1.0, and that could be because there's very low exposure, or it could be because the coefficient actually is very, very close to 1.0 anyway. So we can combine those two. We can have ordered variables, we can have unordered variables in our models. This is what we're doing with the unordered. This is what we're doing with the ordered variables. So only where there's a very credible difference between levels will we add that in. Where nearby next door neighbor levels are there's low credibility in the difference, either because of low exposure or because they have very similar observed target, they will be grouped together in a step function. And this is where the sort of GAM comes into it. We're fitting a step function rather than a linear fit. So one more thing we can do with this approach is if we have a very strong prior knowledge or prior opinion on what good coefficients should look like, we can actually start building from an offset. And rather than that would mean that rather than penalizing towards a 1.0 factor, we'd now be penalizing towards the offset. And it might seem counterintuitive if you're used to GLM, pure GLM, unpenalized GLM, to have an offset on a variable that we're also fitting into the model, because in an unpenalized world, you will fit to the data. And so if you have an offset, that offset will be sort of optimized away if you're also fitting. Here, when we're penalizing deviations away from an offset, that offset will still have some weight in the final model. So yeah, this can be really, really useful for refitting existing models where you want to minimize, because you want to minimize the difference away from the previous models, because you do want to minimize the disruption on your portfolio from moving from an old model to a new model. And you know, a benefit of derivative lasso is that it results in the same sort of structure that we're used to with GLMs. So we can transform this into a table. And it's also very flexible, because most models, the statistical model is not necessarily the best actuarial model. So let's say we're modeling something and we're working on past data, but we know that something has changed, and we know we want to incorporate some adjustments. So you know, maybe we know that we've taken some action on the claims side, which is going to reduce claims in a certain segment. We want to then be able to manually reduce that coefficient. And because GLMs, table-based models, are purely transparent and editable and flexible, we can do that in this framework. This slide looks like the text has gone wrong. It's very, very big, but at least you can read it. The Actuarial Society in the US, CAS, Casualty Actuarial Society, has released a monograph on penalized regression and lasso credibility. And actually, some of the exams, I think, now are incorporating some of the information from this monograph. And so, you know, if I think you want to know more about derivative lasso in detail, I would very much recommend reading the monograph. It's quite technical, which is a good thing. It's also written in very American language, so you have to move past that to read it, but yes. I want to now talk about GBM, so switch of pace. I want to talk about, highlight how they're different and what the different use cases for GBMs are versus something like derivative lasso. So a GBM is a tree-based model. The final model structure is an ensemble of decision trees. And during the fitting process, each tree is being added to the model with some weight, possibly. And then the next tree is modeling the residuals of the previous model. So each tree is modeling something slightly different, but they're sort of learning to correct the errors of the previous model. And this way, you end up with a very, very good ensemble where trees are sort of independent of each other, and that's what makes a good ensemble. Having ensemble models work well when there's some independence between the individual models. And GBMs, I think since around 2015 or more, since then, so maybe the last 10 years even, they've been around. Probably the last 5 years, they've really increased in popularity in pricing. And why? There's some very, very strong use cases for GBMs in pricing. So because of the way that they're structured with decision trees, they can be very good at finding signal automatically in data where there is deep interactions. And it tends to be data sets where there's lots and lots of data, lots and lots of signal for the trees to soak up. So short-term insurance, some very good use cases in portfolios that are big, frequency models where for perils where there's lots and lots and lots of claims, they work well. They work less well on smaller, noisier data sets or data sets where the main effects are linear, then GLMs may work better. But yeah, they work best on data sets with lots of signal and little noise. And due to their nature, they are less transparent than GLMs. That means where you have use cases for models where you don't care so much about the transparency, then GBMs could be a perfect candidate for that. So that could be things like reverse engineering competitors' prices. And also just be using them as a benchmark model that you want to compare your GLMs to. That's another good use case. So building market models. I do think they are being increasingly used for risk models as well, or as ensembles with GLMs. They've been used a lot in demand modeling. Again, you don't care so much about transparency, maybe in demand modeling. And to challenge existing rates. But they aren't anywhere near as transparent or interpretable as GLMs, and this is a con. Now I'm a big fan of GBMs. I used to use them all the time, I like Shapley values as well. So Shapley values, Shap values are a technique where you can find the feature importance. Not just at a model level, so which features are most important in my model, but at an individual profile level. So which were the features which are most important in making the prediction for this profile? And because there's lots and lots of interactions embedded in a GBM, this will be different from profile to profile. So in a GLM, if you fit only one-way effects in a GLM, then the driver age curve is essentially the same for every customer, whereas for GBMs it won't be, and the feature importance won't be. And this gives a high level of interpretability. That's not the same thing as being transparent. There can be edge cases and corner cases that maybe don't exist in your data that you you wouldn't pick up by using Shap values. It is computationally expensive as well. But I'm a fan of GBMs and Shap values as a means of interpreting them. But it just isn't as transparent as a GLM. This is an example, maybe an extreme example. What we're looking at is a partial dependency plot for driver age for some model. And the black line is the partial dependency plot, meaning the sort of weighted average driver curve for this model. But you can also see, maybe not, I don't know how easy it is for you to pick it up, but there are thinner black lines, and those are individual conditional expectation curves, ICE curves, for individual profiles within this model. And because a GBM has lots of interactions, and maybe in this model there's lots of interactions with driver age, that shape is different for every profile, pretty much. It may not be completely appropriate for every single profile. Now, there are means of making things more appropriate by maybe setting monotonicity constraints and so on. But my point is, a GBM is more complex, is less transparent. And let's say you're in that position that I was talking about before, where you know that something has changed and you want to adjust things. It's not particularly easy to adjust things. You may want to adjust things on an individual profile by profile basis, but that's almost impossible. All you can really do is sort of add in some multipliers or something on top of a GBM, and that's an extra layer of complexity that doesn't necessarily fix the problem for every profile. So you can see that there can be problems working with GBMs. Another problem is when you let's say you put a GBM into production, in the next cycle of modeling, you refit that GBM. You don't have very much control over the difference in predictions from your new model to your old model. So you may have more disruption on your portfolio if you use GBMs as your core pricing models. That said, the flip side is they can be more predictive, especially on the bigger perils, especially on the frequency models. Yes, so let's skip through this slide. So let's just do this is a case study comparison. So this is a real life example. This comes from a European insurer, a sort of larger, medium-sized insurer in their market. And this is a claims frequency model on the peril that has the most, it's motor, and I think it's property damage claims. And you can see that on our train data, on our holdout data, and on our out-of-time data, the GBM does outperform the GLM in all three cases. So if the only thing you care about is performance, for this model you would go with a GBM. Then maybe there might be other models, severity models, or models on noisier perils, where a GLM might actually be closer or even better. But I think this highlights another property of GBMs, which is that they can have a variance problem. They can have higher variance and be less stable between the data they're trained on and the data they're put into production on, the future data. GLMs, have maybe the opposite problem. They maybe have more of a bias problem, maybe underfit a bit more, but are more generalizable and more stable over time. And actually, you probably could do better than a GLM and a GBM by having an ensemble of both. Probably would work better than either. To sum up, and I started my talk very early, so I think I'm on about the time that I was expecting. Derivative lasso, I think, is a really useful technique to build GLM models with a lot more speed, but a bit more sort of consistency in the outcome as well, because it relies a lot less on human manual decision making, where we're deciding exactly how to parameterize variable by variable by variable. And you might be able to then with a derivative lasso model, get yourself to sort of 90-95% of the final model, and then add in some more things by hand, as though it was back in the sort of traditional model building GLM framework. So they're easier to incorporate actuarial judgment. They're easy to put into production. They're table-based models. And with the ability to put in offsets, you can kind of have this credibility approach where the offset has some weight in the final model. So you're deciding how much credibility to give to the offset versus to your training data when you tune that smoothing parameter. They're very, very different to GBMs. They also require a bit more setup. A GBM, you have out-of-the-box routines like XGBoost, like GBM, and so on, and you can get going very, very quickly. In a lot of cases, they have a higher performance power. A lot of the time, that's what we care about, but it's not all we care about. And yes, they can be harder to incorporate domain knowledge into. Just because of that sort of black box structure. I was aiming for 45 minutes in total, including Q&A, and I started very early. So we're way ahead, I think, of the published schedule, but I'm happy to open for questions and answers.
Thanks very much, Edwin. And just a reminder to everyone online, please post your questions in the Q&A section and we'll also get around to them. So, any questions?
It was a very interesting discussion. I just want to ask about the difference between interpretability and transparency that you discussed.
Yeah, let me revisit. So, what do I mean by interpretability? Essentially, with something like SHAP, or there are other techniques, you can interrogate a model like a GBM, which is black box by structure. You can see which variables are the most important, what effect they have on individual profiles, which variables are most important on different profiles, and you can use all of this information to help interpret the model. And some of these techniques have been developed over the last few years, and SHAP is a very commonly used one. They are very, very good at helping you to understand and interpret the model, but that is not the same as that the model is fully transparent to you. So in a rating table style model, you can literally look table by table by table, and you can see, you can sort of split the model into its individual components, and you can understand exactly what's going on each component, and that gives you a good idea of what's going on at the model level. Whereas for a tree based ensemble, you can look at an individual decision tree and maybe understand it, but when you have 100 or 1,000 decision trees that you're averaging together, there's no way that you can fully grasp and understand that model. So that's the difference, and sometimes interpretability is enough. So like I said, I'm a fan of GBMs and SHAP, and I think it's a really, really useful technique to have as a tool in our toolbox to be used appropriately. Did that answer your question?
Thanks,
Clive. You got to go easy on me.
maybe just questions around geography. I guess we're slightly different to Europe. We don't have the nice flood models, and location for a lot of us is difficult. Like, we get approximate locations, and if I look at GBMs, you get those horrible blocks.
Oh, yeah.
And if you go fit it in, like, South Africa, you end up with horrible, well, unfairness that you introduce, and it aligns to highways often. Any suggestions around how we, and I think derivative lasso has got some challenges on geography, any ideas on how you can put geography in, or methods you've seen that worked?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to. So obviously, I work for Accurate, and we have our own technique for doing that. But so small plug. So yeah, Yes. So derivative lasso is sort of a framework for fitting GLMs. So you know, there's no difference. There's no downside to moving from a GLM to derivative lasso if that's what you do. But yes, I take your point. There was nothing in my talk that's specific to geography. Geography you can sort of think of as either fitting a smooth surface or using external data on geography. So you could, of course, use external data like, you know, population density or whatever you want as the regressors that go into a derivative lasso. But yeah, you probably want to, in the same way that GLMs have a problem, just vanilla GLMs have a problem with geography, derivative lasso doesn't fix that. You would have to do something else on top, some sort of spatial smoothing or something. Like I said, I think it's a solved problem in our software, but yeah, if you're doing it yourself in Python or something, then you have to think about that. Maybe it's out of scope for this talk.
Cool. Thanks for that, Edwin. So the question I have, I think the first one is around for GLMs, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of pricing teams would split the data, let's just say 80-20, and
yes,
then the 20 is completely random. It's not really time-based. So what's your thoughts on the temporal leakage that does exist? And I guess the other argument on that is if we split, let's just say, 2020 to 2023, and then we test on 2024, that's our most recent data that we're actually leaving out from training the model. So yeah, what's your thoughts on that?
I would again say it was a little bit tangential, but yes, it's a very interesting question, and there are obviously pros and cons to whatever approach you take. So if you're splitting at random, then you need to think about time consistency somehow, I think. You maybe want to sort of fit an interaction between your variable and your time variable and see whether, you know, does each variable fit well on the individual years? Are the results I'm fitting time stable? But yes, if you use a time holdout, you know, by nature, you're going to be favoring models that are stable over time, but then you have other problems potentially with, you know, you probably want some of the data from your most recent year to be taken into account in your models because, you know, that's the most relevant data, so you don't necessarily want to use it for all the holdout. So yeah, there are pros and cons. I don't know, we can have a long discussion on different validation approaches.
And then the second one is just around, yep, does Accurate allow for any weighting techniques to be applied to the data so that maybe you can weight, if you have a 5-year data set, then you can weight maybe more towards, you know, the last or year 5 and year 4 and then lower amounts to the other years?
Accurate does, and I think most of our competitors do as well. I'm not trying to advertise Accurate, but yeah, if you're working in Python on a derivative lasso, you mean most fitting algorithms will have something like a weight. I mean, exposure is usually what we use for weighting, so we could just change that to sort of upweight the future years if that's something that is actuarially appropriate for the data set that you're using. Yes, I'd say that's, you know, right. Obviously, if you do that, then the data becomes slightly more noisy in a sense, because, you know, you're downweighting the rest of the data set. But yeah, it can be appropriate sometimes when things have changed and you know one part of the data is, you know, there are problems with one part of the data compared to the other or something.
All right, cool, thanks.
Morning, Edwin. Thank you. At the start of the presentation,
yep,
if I'm remembering, there was a slide that said, you know, GLMs, you either choose to use, like, rely fully on the data or not at all.
Yes. I didn't speak to that, did I?
No.
But, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess my question there then is, in these two approaches that you showed us then today, the derivative lassos and the GBM, in what ways is that not the case, you know, if okay. that's the argument you're presenting?
Yeah, so a lot of times when you're building just a vanilla GLM manually, especially when you get towards the end of the modeling process, you're deciding, should I include this variable or not? And maybe you're looking at p-values, maybe you're looking at cross-validation or AIC or BIC or whatever. But that is a binary choice. You're either including it or you're not including it. And if you're including it, you're giving essentially 100% credibility to that effect in your data. And if you're not, you know, it's flat. You're not including it at all. Probably, you know, in most cases, the reality lies somewhere in between those two extremes. And that's what penalization brings, because you're allowing effect to enter the model, but you're penalizing it for being too close to the data. All of the GBM routines that I mentioned will have some kind of regularization built into them as well. So both of the techniques I talked about, derivative lasso and GBMs, don't have that problem necessarily of having that binary decision, and you know they're sort of moving in the direction of the data, and you know it's up to the modeler how, you know, what level of smoothness do I choose for the derivative lasso, or you know how many trees do I build for the GBM, or so on. Does that answer your question or address your question?
I think so. Because the approach I'm thinking is, especially with like sort of taking credibility approach with the data that you have, is then, you know, you mentioned the use of an offset. So is this like, you know, outside of just sort of an offset? So, you know, so it's the number of trees in a GBM, and then it's the kind of the smoothness where you choose the smoothness on the derivative lasso.
Yeah. So GBMs have many different hyperparameters that you can tune that will have some kind of regularizing effect, whereas derivative lasso basically has that one parameter. So yeah, number of trees, it has a similar effect, because you know the more trees you add, the closer you're fitting to the data, and you know you're potentially adding bias overfitting, but you're also reducing adding variance overfitting, but you're also reducing bias. So you want to get that right trade-off. There are other parameters, hyperparameters in a GBM, that they literally have lasso and ridge parameters in them. I think almost all of the, it's been a while since I've used some of those, but yeah, there's multiple ones that basically have that. You can plot that same graph, you know, the trade-off between bias and variance.
Okay, yeah, thank you. That does answer my question then.
Okay.
I'll come there now. We also have an online question from Alberto. He's asking, how do you deal with wiggliness or noise in nonlinear relationships in derivative lasso techniques? How JMs deal with this is penalizing the second derivatives.
Sorry, I didn't get that at all.
How do you deal with wiggliness or noise in nonlinear relationships in derivative lasso techniques? How GAMs deal with this is penalizing the second derivatives.
So how penalized GLMs, I guess. I'm still not exactly clear on what the question means. I just don't know how to address that question in a good way.
No problem. I think we'll just ask we can reach out.
I think
afterwards
I could, yes,
clarify.
If we can
no
reach
problem.
Out and ask for clarification, I can be very, very happy to address whatever the point is. And apologies.
Thank you so much. I wanted to ask, I saw on one of your slides, use Gini as a metric of, in your guys' opinion, is Gini one of the best model validation choices?
I like using both Gini and some deviance-based metric, because they both measure something slightly different. So Gini is how well the model orders the risks from low risk to high risk, which is what we want. But it's invariant to if the model is badly calibrated, the model Gini can still look good. even if actually the model is, you know, predicting double what it should do. So having looking at a deviance-based metric as well, I think is very useful. And most of the time when you're looking at validation data or holdout data, a model that improves the genie is also probably going to improve the deviance. Sometimes they disagree, and then you probably you pick the whichever model is the simpler of the two if you're choosing between. But yeah, I think they can both diagnose different problems in your model. So I would typically use both.
Okay, and how would you choose the correct deviance function?
So what's the question? How would
you choose the correct deviance function that you're minimizing or you using as your criteria?
Well, I usually look at pseudo R squared, but that is just based on deviance. I mean, they are, you know, the deviance improves, the pseudo R squared improves, the log likelihood improves. They're all basically the same thing. I don't know if that was your question or whether I missed something.
No. Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions on the floor here? If there is anything else, we'll definitely just please do send them through. We'll share them with Edwin
absolutely.
And get your questions answered for you. So, Edwin, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it. And here's just a small token of appreciation for your time today.